he came into contact with Americans, a variety of people that previous emperors never had contact with.
A new era begins in Japan. It's Wednesday, May 1st. This is VOA Asia. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Also find us on Facebook at VOA Asia. Coming up, U.S. farmers weather tariff costs. Religious freedom is under attack. Indian potatoes and Japanese cars highlight business news. Exchanging damaged money and lobster plastics. It's all on today's VOA Asia. Japanese Emperor Akihito announced his abdication at a palace ceremony Tuesday in his final address, as the nation embraced the end of his reign with reminiscence and hope for a new era. As he walked out of the room following his speech, Akihito turned around, paused, and bowed to the audience. His reign ran through midnight when his son, Crown Prince Naruhito, who observed Akihito's abdication ceremony, became the new emperor, and his era began. Akihito's reign is being seen by many as one where the Japanese population approved of what he was doing. Recent media surveys have shown public support for the imperial family at 80%. That's the highest ever for the institution. Annika Culver, Associate Professor of East Asian History at Florida State University, further explained to VOA Asia's Ira Melman how Akihito drew that approval.
I wouldn't exactly call him a people's emperor, but he just seems to have a kind of personality that he has this open curiosity about the people he meets. And also, if you trace him from his kind of early years when he was groomed for the imperial position as a child and then a teenager, much of his young adulthood was under the auspices of the U.S. occupation through his Quaker tutor, Elizabeth Vining. So he came into contact with Americans, a variety of people that previous emperors never had contact with. He also endeared himself to the Japanese public by jogging around the Imperial Palace, and it became kind of a ritual to see if you could see him. And this was maybe about 15, 20 years back or so, where he could be seen doing a circuit around the Imperial Palace. I'm not exactly sure the distance, if it's an exact 5K or not, but you know, just the fact that he seemed accessible. Of course, the Imperial Household Agency does a lot of curating of his appearances, and they do a lot of handling. But he generally gives the impression that he's not removed from the people. He just has this kind of happy-go-lucky personality that endears him to other people, and I think that he's had to, right, because of the dark image, especially in terms of the mind of Japan's Asian neighbors, of Emperor Hirohito as being this distant figure perched atop a white horse in a military uniform. That's kind of the iconic image that you have of the Showa Emperor, whereas Akihito, you see him smiling and waving his hand, and that's one of the photos that strikes me as communicating that new vision.
What has led to this abdication?
I think it's a really smart move on behalf of Emperor Akihito that he steps down at a time when he's aging. He's in his early 80s. For him to pass down power to his son, who kind of gives this image of a youthful Japan, right? Instead of an aging population, we have a hearty and hale Crown Prince Naruhito, now becoming Emperor Naruhito, at a time when Japan is dealing with these issues of aging, and also how to kind of reposition itself in the world instead of Japan passing, Japan having kind of this active role in global endeavors that still kind of communicate peace, the spreading of peace, rather than a more kind of militaristic image, which some of Japan's Asian neighbors have been concerned with Abe's initiatives. possible revision of the Constitution, more like reinterpretation to many different degrees. And so Emperor Naruhito's goal, I think, as a not a person with political power, but with important symbolic power, is to show Japan as a responsible global power with the ability to kind of proactively contribute to peace.
Many things you have said about the imperial family reminds me of the British royal family.
Yes, very much so.
And is the Japanese imperial family as loved as the British royal family is?
Well, you know, the Brits have their tabloids, and I'm not sure if, well, loved or just interested in. You know, it's fascinating. Like, if you go to Japan, they also have their own tabloids. And, of course, with the imperial family in Japan, there's a little bit more respect than British tabloids extend to, you know, their targets, right? And I think it's still kind of part of this mystique of the imperial institution, which harkens back to pre-war and wartime times. Older generations have a huge amount of respect for the imperial institution and the imperial family. I think younger people are more, you know, interested in them as people instead of symbols of an institution. But I just think, yeah, they're interesting parallels, but I think also the connections with England are quite important because of the kind of traditional education of the aristocracy in England.
Naruhito will formally ascend the chrysanthemum throne on Wednesday. His wife Masako and daughter Aiko were barred from the ceremony because they are female members of the royal family, a palace tradition that the government upheld despite criticism that it is out of step with modern values. These are among some of the top Asia stories that you'll find when you visit voanews.com right now. Thailand prepares for first coronation in 7 decades. Activists urge China not to repatriate North Korean defectors. U.S. Treasury Secretary hopes for substantial progress in China talks. Indonesia charts 2 soft courses to contain China. China's Xi appeals to youth patriotism on centenary of student protests. You'll find expanded coverage of these stories and much more when you visit Facebook at VOA Asia, as well as the voanews.com website. VOA Asia continues. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. As U.S. farmers prepare for planting this year, they do so under a cloud of uncertainty created by continuing tariffs on U.S. grain exports. They also aren't buying new equipment, which VOA's Kane Faribault reports is a growing concern for manufacturers who not only see declining sales, but increasing costs for the material they need to create their products.
Their iconic blue-colored equipment is recognizable on many farms across the country.
We're known for our planters and grain carts.
Products easily spotted in large displays in front of Kinsey's manufacturing hub along Interstate 80 in Williamsburg, Iowa, where the company employs over 500 people, most of them working with one key component.
Steel's obviously the lifeblood of Kinsey, where our factory is essentially a weld house. We cut, burn, shape, form, paint steel.
Steel, which now costs more, the result of a 25% tariff on the material imported from most countries.
When there's a tariff on steel, it cuts right to the core of our fundamental product construction.
President Donald Trump imposed the tariffs with the goal of boosting U.S. steel production and related employment. While there has been a modest benefit to the domestic steel industry, Dix says increased costs are negatively impacting companies like Kinsey.
And those tariffs take their effect on our cost structure, on our profitability for the family, through our employees and out to our dealers and on to the final customers.
Those customers are mostly U.S. farmers who use Kinsey's products to plant soybean seeds. Soybean exports are now subject to retaliatory tariffs, which have sunk prices and contributed to another year of overall declining income for U.S. farmers. Concerns Dix explained to U.S. Republican Senator Joni Ernst of Iowa, who participated in a roundtable discussion at Kinsey, along with farmers and others in Iowa impacted by tariffs. Ernst says the personal stories she gathers from these meetings go a long way in helping Trump understand the impact on her constituents.
He has a very different negotiating style, so he wants to start with the worst possible scenario and negotiate his way to a good and fair deal.
But Dix says 1 year under tariffs has already taken a toll on Kinsey's operations.
We're not really that big, so when I say that this impact has been a seven-figure impact for us in the past year, that's a substantial amount of money.
An amount that so far hasn't been passed on to customers or employees. Kane Fairbaugh, VOA News, Williamsburg, Iowa.
Happening now in Asia, U.S. Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin says he hopes to make substantial progress in trade talks with China as the world's two largest economies try to reach a resolution to their trade war. Trade negotiators from both nations meet this week in Beijing and in Washington next week. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. We're glad, as always, to have you with us on VOA Asia. Thanks for listening. An independent U.S. watchdog group labeled 16 nations as countries of particular concern for engaging in systematic, ongoing, egregious violations of religious freedom. The U.S. Commission on International Religious Freedom cited China as one of the worst violators, detaining between 800,000 and 2 million adult Uyghur Muslims in concentration camps and relegating some of their children to orphanages simply because of their religious identity. VOA's diplomatic correspondent Cindy Sain has more from the State Department.
When it comes to violating religious rights, Commissioner Gary Bauer tells VOA China is in a league of its own, most notably with its internment and torture of Uyghur Muslims.
But it's also against Tibetan Buddhists, against Falun Dong, against the house churches, and now even the licensed churches. And there's one theme in all of this, that anytime the Chinese government sees that one of their citizens might feel a loyalty to something other than the Chinese communist government, they're threatened by that and they do everything they can to try to stamp it out.
Bauer says the U.S. knows which Chinese officials are responsible for severe religious freedom violations, and it needs to name them and press Chinese leaders to immediately set Uyghurs and other Muslims free. The commission says conditions for religious freedom also deteriorated in Nigeria in 2018, with the Nigerian government at national and state levels tolerating violence and discrimination.
I think Nigeria is on the list for a number of different reasons, including the ways in which it has tolerated, right, the kind of violence by non-state actors.
Several of the commissioners pointed out that increasingly, houses of worship around the world are finding themselves the targets of deadly terrorist attacks. Democratic Congressman Jim McGovern agrees.
We saw the terrible tragedy that just recently happened in California, another attack on a synagogue. We see attacks against the Muslim population in the United States and around the world. We've seen Christian churches being a focus of attacks here in the United States. So when we talk about religious freedom, it's not just halfway around the world, it's halfway down the block.
McGovern and Republican members of Congress said protecting houses of worship and religious freedom around the world is one issue that Americans across the political spectrum can agree on. Cindy Sain, VOA News, the State Department.
Coming up, a dispute over potatoes some Indian farmers grow. You're listening to VOA Asia.
VOA Special English. A way to learn American English and much more. Broadcasting a half hour of world news and features every day on radio. You can also find Special English on television and online at voaspecialenglish.com. For 50 years, helping people understand world events and the language and culture of America.
This news from VOA Asia. Activists are urging China not to repatriate 7 North Koreans who were detained in an eastern Chinese province after leaving their homeland. The group, which includes a 9-year-old girl, fled North Korea last month but was detained by Chinese authorities. Visit VOA Asia Facebook each day for top stories and great features you can see and share. This is VOA Asia. As we continue now with VOA Asia, a settlement on profitable potatoes and more auto trade with Japan. These are the topics on today's VOA Asia Business Scene with Skylar Ogden.
PepsiCo has offered to settle with a group of Indian farmers it was suing for using its patented potatoes. The farmers were cultivating the FC5 potato variety, which is exclusively grown for PepsiCo's popular Lay's potato chips. Since the lawsuit began, farmer activists have been fighting back. Farmer Jigar Patel.
PepsiCo is saying that it is their potato, but how will the farmer get to know? We don't have any laboratory.
The company, which set up its first potato chips plant in India in 1989, supplies the same FC5 potato variety to a different group of farmers who, in turn, sell their produce back to the company at a fixed price. PepsiCo is now offering a similar deal to the Indian potato growers in the lawsuit. Anand Yannick is a lawyer for PepsiCo.
PepsiCo company.
PepsiCo on its own submitted orally to the court that they would like to settle this issue in dispute with the farmers. Either farmers shall not use FC5 in the future, or they may enter into agreement with PepsiCo, purchase the seeds from them, and sell produce or the potatoes to them.
A lawyer for the farmers has asked for time to consider the offer, and the next court hearing is due June 12th. U.S. President Donald Trump is pressing Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe to have Japanese automakers produce more vehicles in the United States. Toyota, Japan's largest automaker, said last month it would exceed a 2017 pledge to invest $10 billion over 5 years, with a new commitment to reach nearly $13 billion over that period. At a campaign rally in Green Bay, Wisconsin on Saturday, Trump praised the new investments. Referring to Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe, Trump said,
"He started by saying that he's putting $40 billion into the United States for new car factories. Toyota's coming in with $14 billion. Many, many companies are coming in."
President Donald Trump has been a longtime advocate of boosting the American car manufacturing industry. As the White House threatens to impose tariffs of up to 25% on imported vehicles, he has simultaneously been prodding Japanese automakers to add more jobs and factories in the United States. President Trump is taking a trip to Japan in late May to celebrate the new Emperor of Japan. He says it's possible the United States and Japan will reach a new bilateral trade deal by that time. For VOA's Business Scene, I'm Skylar Ogden.
This news from VOA Asia, much to the dismay of social media followers around the world, the Indian Army wrote on Twitter Tuesday that it found footprints of the Yeti. Known in North America as Bigfoot, the Yeti is a mythical creature often described as ape-like and larger than human and living in the Himalayas. You'll find verified news throughout the day on VOA Asia Facebook. This is VOA Asia. Now on VOA Asia, if you happen to have some U.S. currency that is burnt, drenched, or even shredded into pieces, the remains can be legally exchanged at the U.S. Bureau of Engraving and Printing. The main condition for exchange is that more than 50% of the banknote should be identifiable as U.S. currency. Lisa Bakalets talked with the Treasury Department experts and learned more about their unusual work as Anna Rice narrates her story.
Dirty money, literally, is accepted here at the U.S. Bureau of Engraving and Printing. So is the money that's in really bad shape.
Any money that's been somehow damaged to the extent where you can't determine the value, this is the only place in the world that will accept U.S. currency.
Bureau employees even try to piece together shredded banknotes.
Just try to find the identifiable parts, like the mouth, the nose, eyes.
Most of the money is damaged in fires and floods, say Bureau employees. In one case, an individual who didn't trust banks after the housing market crash withdrew $2 million and stored it in a garage.
The money stored in a bag, but water had creeped in the bag and the notes had solidified together when they went to retrieve it.
Then there is money damaged by pets. Bureau employees go to surprising lengths to save it.
Sometimes it's just if you leave $20 on the coffee table, the dog will come and chew it up. Sometimes
really?
The dog will actually eat it, and the owner will wait a few days and then wait for the dog to process it out. We do require you to wash it off before you send it in to us.
Walsh has worked on money damaged in the 9/11 attacks, Hurricane Katrina, and wildfires in California. One of his strangest cases took place a few decades ago.
Back in the early 80s, there was a farmer that lost his wallet in a field, and he discovered that his cow had eaten his wallet. And we always encourage people to send the currency in its original packaging. That way they don't cause further damage. He had sent it in the cow's stomach, and then the people that were working at the time had to deal with that.
Since then, the guidelines to process claims have gotten more specific.
We usually get about 24,000 submissions a year, and we reimburse just north of $40 million.
Anyone can mail in damaged money or personally bring it to the Bureau. If the examiner can recover at least 51% of the banknote, it will be exchanged for a new one. The old, damaged currency is then taken out of circulation. For Леся Бакалец in Washington, Anna Rice, VOA News.
The world has a love-hate relationship with plastic. It's as convenient as it is problematic. Because it degrades incredibly slowly, plastic waste pollutes the oceans and endangers wildlife. But for sturdy, cheap, and sterile packaging, we simply lack good alternatives. Marcus Meyer-Galen tells us a London startup wants to change that with some help from lobsters.
We use it all the time. Plastic packaging for pills, plants, and groceries. But these products are special. Because instead of polluting the seas, they come from the sea. Lobster shells are the main ingredient for this alternative to conventional plastic. A London-based startup called The Shellworks wants to replace unsustainable materials with environmentally friendly ones. The startup sees potential in seafood waste.
We identified within that actually seafood waste is something that's not being looked at, but within crustacean shells there's a really valuable biopolymer called chitin. So we sought to kind of extract this chitin from the shells and see whether we could find an alternative to single-use plastics.
To do this, the team crushes the lobster shells and extracts the chitin. Adding a little bit of household vinegar forms a dense liquid, which can then be shaped into the desired form, like a plastic bag.
It's antifungal and antibacterial, which means that it would be really interesting for storing foods. And at the end of life, it's actually a non-polluting fertilizer. So even if you had a bag at home, you could just chop it up, throw it into your plant pots, and it would just help them grow.
That would mean less plastic polluting the environment. But is this alternative viable on a large scale? The Shellwork team says yes. At least in cities, lobster shells are readily available as food waste from big restaurants.
We've been trying to understand how we could scale this, and we reached out to one lobster chain within London. And what we found is they actually have 375 tons of lobsters going to waste every year, which means chitin content-wise, that's 125,000 kilograms. And from that, every year, we could make about 7.5 million plastic bags.
Lobster shells alone won't be able to replace the plastic we use every day, but they could be a piece of the puzzle of creating a more sustainable product cycle. Marcus Meyer-Gielen for VOA News, Washington.
You've been listening to VOA Asia. You'll find us on great radio stations around Asia, like the voice of Chungrung, Star Radio FM 88.3. At Chungrung Christian University in Tainan, Taiwan. We thank everyone there who's tuned in today. If you only caught part of our program, you can catch the whole thing online. Go to iTunes and SoundCloud or VOA Asia Facebook and our website, voanews.com. We also thank our director, Tracy Carter, our engineer, Cedric Franklin, managing editor, Diane Gao, and our VOA Asia team, Skylar Ogden, Ira Melman, Keith Lane, and Anna Cook. I'm Jim Stevenson. We're in Washington. We hope you have a great day ahead.